Hello everyone, my name is Ken Chen, so I'm from Tokyo National Astronomical Observatory of Japan. So first of all, thanks organizers for having me here and this KITV. So today I would like to talk about this, about the death of very massive stars and how they may contribute some of understanding about the mass loss from these massive stars. So So this is a mist of the massive star we have been discussed about past 2 weeks, and the insight by these many distinguished participants, rotational by George Noble, Tom Mars, Yeri Pablo, they talk about all these rotational things and missing length theory and how they impact the stellar evolution and to incorporate to the 1-2 models. And the conventional physics part by Raphael, Stan, and Matteo, and Elliot, they provide also very strong, useful understanding physical picture for this convention developed inside this massive star. And the very impressive simulation done by Yang Fei, also by Matteo, showing how they really work. Maybe we look at these simulations. Hopefully, in the near future, not today, the theory talked about the death of massive star supernovas, and Ryan and Nathan, they will contribute some of the observational part, and also Ken Nomoto here will contribute some of the theoretical part of the supernova to help understanding about the mass loss rate and death of the massive star. So the mass loss rate actually really a big impact to the death of massive star, because mass is a very critical parameter to determine this death of especially fat, massive stars. But however, the other end is like the death of massive star on the other way can try to contribute some of the mass loss rate, for example. So I was trying to understanding these are all very beautiful process, but you want to lose mass rate, you need the energy. And who the pay the bill for the mass loss rate? Or some of these are giant eruption case. So these I hope you understand. So let's look at the death of non-rotational massive stars case here. These are the main sequence mass. These are helium core mass. These are the probably associated supernova explosion mechanism. However, this is a main sequence mass are pretty unknown because we don't know exactly how massive star and how much mass they lost during their evolutions. But once we know the center, the core, the helium core especially, as long as we know the mass of this helium core, we probably good judgment to determine the fate of last stars. So if you have the helium core between 2 to 32, those guys, you will collect at least into a neutron star, or more of them will become black hole. And if you want the core collect explosion, like Terry mentioned, maybe you need some magic, then you will bomb or mana bomb. And however, into this more heavier region, 35 to 60, the into so-called pair instability region. And in this period, it's called the positional pair instability and the pair instability. These are the region I'm going to discuss about these and how they relevant to the mass loss of massive stars. So the idea is here. Once your star initial mass is about 80, roughly, they fall into a helium core, start helium burning, form a carbon-oxygen core. And at this moment, this core, the entropy was very big. So when the photon hit the nuclei, it will produce electron-partition pairs. And those pairs are important. However, this is a radiation support by the core is supported by the radiation. Now you took the radiation away. Now you soften the radiation pressure support. This core becomes unstable then it collapses. Then it collapses, compressed cold will ignite the later nuclear burning. How much energy released from such nuclear burning will determine the fate of these stars. Fortunately, this, unlike the neutrino-driven explosion of SASE or other more complex structure, these are actually the thermonuclear explosions. And we make a nuclear bomb, we have better understanding and better nuclear physics understanding such kind of explosion. So that's a very good thing. So all the story began from Stan. So I was working with Stan quite a long time. So Stan, once he started modeling these 80 solar mass stars, after the central, these are non-rotating stars, the central oxygen burning depleted. Now the cold enter this parent stability region. Now the temperature start to fluctuate like this. And this is a period about 500 seconds. And this kind of fluctuation is the cold enter the parent stability. However, the cold is able to restore itself. So eventually, this cold collapses into a black hole. At this moment, this parent stability doesn't play much role to affect the codes, just like a little fluctuation here. It boosts to 90 solar masses. Now helium core boosts to 41.3 solar masses. Again, such fluctuating pulsation start to occur again. However, in this model, actually two big eruptions occurred about 2 days before the star dies. And such eruption carry certain amount of energy, and this energy eventually turn into shock. And the light kind of be able to eject some of the mass from the envelopes. So this is now the starting play a role here. So the picture is, at the death of the massive star for this parent stability case, some of them might be able to erupt or eject some of the material outside and in a certain very short period. Maybe I mean like heat years or less than centuries, for example, and give you this like an eruption, a lot of mass loss rate in a short time. So these are the examples from Stan for different helium core mass, and the colors show the blue color shows entropy, and the red color shows temperatures. And you see, again, this is like a pulsation. The pulsation, actually, the number of pulsation decreased as the core become more and more heavier. However, they also become more and more energetic. Pulsation number fewer, but more energetic. And in this case, they eject 0.1 to 8 solar mass, but these are the helium core. So, however, if less hydrogen encroaches these stars, this hydrogen will be easily unbound by such kind of eruptions. So, this is the total energy of the pulse in terms of the helium core. So, at about maybe 53, this pulse, you have many, many pulse, and this pulse are the energy around 10 to 49, 10 to 50 Hertz. And these are at the lower mass end, this kind of eruption will be able to produce some of the subluminous supernova like an event. But once you go more massive scale, the pulse become fewer, the duration become longer, and the more energetic. And this actually have a very diverse, interesting observational signature you will be observed. Like a normal supernova, you can have superluminous supernova, I will brief mention, and you may have radio X-ray transit in the region.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So you say normal supernova can come out of this. Is there any nickel produced?
It's just determine the energy of the explosion. So here I mentioned the normal supernova is the energy come out from such eruption is comparable to the normal supernova explosion.
Okay,
and that produce depends on how much hydrogen and how much outside, how much things outside, but they can produce some similar type 2.
But that doesn't mean they would look like it on ordinary supernova.
That doesn't mean they will look like exactly. The normal, I mean the energy labels, in terms of the energy.
So did any of the supernovae with known precursors have light curves consistent with the apparent stability of supernovae?
Yeah, they are actually expert, Nathan and Ryan.
Well, sure, because the apparent stability can make any kind of light curve. So yes,
But I want to also comment on that, because you know, these pulsational paths are really supernovae. People say there is a precursor and then there is a real supernova. But we're talking about very massive stars here. I would say the standard wisdom is we don't get a supernova in the end, but a black hole.
Yes. Right? So the final moment, actually the central part of the remaining part of the star, actually it will become a black hole. You will collide a black hole because too much is massive. But during this period, the VT regime is able to release.
That's in the pulsational case?
Yes.
Can I ask, pulsation case, how was the amount of ejected material calculated? Is it O1D?
In this 1D, these are the results from the STENS 1D evolution models. But later I will show you an example of the multi-dimensional simulations.
But it's dynamic, of course. So I mean,
yeah. So basically, you have an eruption, like an explosion, and that energy, 10 to 49, 10 to 50 ergs of energy, it creates a shock. That shock easily unbound the envelope, which only have binding energy
You can spend the energy on unbinding the upper parts, yes. Or you can spend it on expanding the inner parts. You can differentiate the energy. So that was my question.
Yeah, in here, the energy in terms of shock wave, but that shock wave memory propagate, then unbound the outer part.
Didn't spend anything on expanding the inner.
Oh, none didn't spend anything. There's something, but the core expanded, but the core will expand. It will collide the Kelvin Helmholtz time scale. It will
recollect. The eject is primarily going to come from the hydrogen layer and some from the helium.
Yes, that's correct.
So that's back to Norbert's comment again, is that the ejecta should have no nickel in it, essentially.
Yes.
The typical supernova, the nickel is coming from post-collapse, and that's not happening here. That's all going away.
That's correct. In this case, the transit you observe, you probably won't see anything nickel, even silicon. Yes.
Are there any 2D or 3D simulations?
Yes. Yes, I done this, so I wish.
Does the picture change at all if you've stripped away the envelope through binary interaction prior to positional parasitism turning on?
It will change. So that's why the STEM only want to model this helium core mass, because the helium core mass actually determine the explosion mechanism. But how much helium core can form actually also relevant to how much envelope you got, the hydrogen envelope to provide the mass to the source. So
can the, just kind of back to Norbert's question, can the pulsations unbind enough material to make it then in a regime where it will collapse and explode rather than just collapse into a black hole? Or you always retain this huge helium core mass, and so you'll collapse directly to a black hole?
Oh, in that case, yes. That, let me see. In the lower mass n case, this eruption carry energy, basically most of the energy take away most of the hydrogen and very little part of the helium stuff. But for the more energetic one, actually there's a good possibility because it's so energetic. So actually carry out much more energy, maybe much of them coming from the region, the cold region of the star, and then make it become like a a normal massive star or less massive star, then might be then they have a chance to study go on this evolution track and to forge the iron become the core collapse supernova.
If I remember Stan's paper on this correctly, right, you because of these pulsations, you basically end up taking that whole range from, of course, from 40 to 65 solar masses and ending up with something like 40 to 45 solar masses. So you might actually expect that one of the possible observational evidences could be that you have a pileup of black hole masses in a narrower mass range, right? Because you basically this wider range of masses ends up in a much narrower range of black hole masses.
Stan also used this kind of positional pair to explain some of these black hole progenitors. Maybe relevant you mentioned here. Yeah.
So you mean like a pile up of 30 solar masses?
Well, he argued 40, not 30, but or 40 to 45. But I mean, okay, then it depends, of course, how much more mass you assume is lost. But yes.
Maybe exactly.
It's possible.
So once you enter this helium core mass about 62 or 633, at this time, this position becomes it's all energetic. So the entire core just unbound, become the parent stability supernova, just one explosion, and everything comes out. There's no compartment in this case. So I also want to show you some of the examples from this multi-dimensional simulation for this positionally paired instability supernova, and an example of the 110 solar mass stars. So this combined 2D and 3D simulation, and most of the movies are made by 2D. But here I want to answer Ryan's question about multi-D simulation. Why people want to use 2D simulations? Because they don't think they can produce a correctly turbulence cascade or some physical quantity or some numerical artifact around the pole. That's correct. That's totally correct. But the 2D actually is a very important step. If like a transaction step between you can do a simple 1D and many 1D model or very, very expensive 3D models. In the 2D, they provide you a regime to help you understanding some of this, especially the fluid instability or something you probably miss in the 1D, but they may not treat very properly. But you can use very high resolution to understanding this before you go on any super expensive 3D simulation. So it's like a step. So that's still very.
The step is in the right direction. Yeah. The step is in the wrong direction. It's not.
Yeah.
Even though it's cheap, if it's in the wrong direction, it's not helpful.
Yes, but
so you have to say that you have to give some proof that we're taking a step in the right direction.
Yes, so in the near future, if people have all very powerful supercomputer on your desktop, that's, of course, we can all jump into the 3D realm. Yes, yes, yeah. This I want to show you this core. So actually, the core is a quarter part of a star, and here show the radial velocity. And this gray color means velocity is negative, which means collapse. This rainbow color means it's part of things got to be ejected. So at this time, almost hydro equilibrium, but very shortly during the pairing stability, the core collapse, and then ignite the nuclear burning release energy, and this energy is sending a very strong shock. And this shock carry energy about 10 to 50 Erks of energy. And then the core, I still do this kind of bouncing and collapsing, and eventually it will reach another equilibrium state before the next eruption might occur. And however, this shock propagated out. This is a velocity plot. Sorry, I didn't plot the scale. You can easily unbind the hydrogen envelope and get it pushed out. So the hydrogen envelope just coming out due to these kind of eruptions. So these are eruption history of these stars. So,
are you going to comment on the physics of these azimuthal features?
This one.
On those
It's going on. So actually, this is actually the one of very simulation I try to do is I try to follow the scale from the very center power star and the nuclear reaction and follow the eruption until the shock wave coming out from the envelope. And the lead is when there's a shock wave erupt, the shock wave break out the stellar surface, and the laser sort of some fluid stability. And not very precisely, so these are the 2D results coming out and attach, unbound this material, and it comes out.
They asked, so to me, this looks at first glance pretty spherical.
Yes.
So if you would redo the or same simulation in 1D, what would be the difference in the outcome?
Yeah, so, yeah, Nover mentioned a very good point. This kind of positional instability supernova, when the eruption occurs, actually there was not too much difference in the fluid instability. But I will show why this MARTD, why we want to do this MARTD when we kick it in. So, because they have produced the shell, different shell at different times. And those shells propagate at different speed. And that shell eventually sort of mess up or collide into each other. And that's a fluid instability kicks in.
So that's a kind of H-myometric
instability? Yeah. It's basically like the Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities.
Yes.
Can I ask, I'm sorry, make
you go back again to that.
You want like this, so actually it's
a very pretty. Where is the mass coordinate of the photosphere?
It's a velocity, so mass, most of mass seals down the very...
So I mean, the mass coordinate of the
photosphere?
How much of the star are we looking at?
How much is the star?
Is that all the way out to the photosphere?
These are all the star. This is the shock wave from this first eruption. And then
is that the photosphere?
Okay. I will tell you where the photosphere later. Yeah. Okay. Be patient. Okay. Sure. So let me go through this eruption episode, and I will tell you about this. So in this case, there are three eruption occurs, and the time duration is the first eruption occurs, and only you left this 110 solar mass star, artificially mass loss to 75 solar mass, and eruption occurs, and the remnant becomes about 50 solar mass star, and just about 6.8 years, there's a second eruption, and consequently, very quickly, a third eruption coming out. And those eruptions come out because the later nuclear burning are more mild and release much energy. So basically, they have higher velocity than the previous eruption. So that means this guy, eventually, the third eruption eventually catch up the second guy, and eventually catch up the things from the first eruption. So these are things, the colliding shells, and they bring the mass about 0.1 solar mass. And this amount of 10 to 50 ergs of the energy going wrong into these first eruptions. And this how we want to understand these pictures in the street, these are 2D simulation movies. So here I try to plot the density, temperature, vorticity, and velocity plots. And the first eruption down is very outside here, the ejecta. The second eruption is this shock, probably this part. The third one is this one. So what happened in this hydro simulation when the shell collide? So when the shell collide, the third and second start to merge. And the merge then run into things formed by the first eruptions. There's a lot of instability happening. This is driven by the memory, the Rayleigh-Taylor instability, because you sort of create a very dense, a second-state material, and the shot going to slow down and driven this reverse shot, and reverse shot start to mix out things behind. But the how is it interesting here? Because such colliding shell relevant to some of the CSM model for this supernova, maybe Ryan and Nathan, they have been observed quite a lot of. And the interesting thing is, this kind of collision process is very effective to convert the kinetic energy of these ejectors and into thermals. However, this merging of the connection site is already become very optically thin. So this is actually the photosphere of this entire star, the ejector. And it is very close. Actually, these are the shocks. But these are the plays, the interplay with the matters and generate the thermal energy. And this energy will soon immediately to release from this moment. Then they will produce a luminous transit.
Could you point out the position of those different pulse shocks in this?
Oh, in here is at
the first pulse.
Actually, they have been traveling in the first pulse. So the second and third actually been merged.
They've already caught up and merged. Great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But that's a picture. So that's an interesting thing. Actually, people maybe observe some of these massive outbursts from massive stars before they die as a supernova. Will that be possible because some of the kind of positional pair instability occurs before the star dies and giving some of the eruption of this mass, a lot of mass eruption coming out before the star dies? This may be an example which they put in the natures. So this recently I've been starting to working with move 2D to 3D, then move to the hydro to radiation hydro simulations, because I want to simulate what happened when this shell of the mass, when the collidings, and how much energy will be generated through this process, and how the structure will be formed during this if the radiation being cooled down and the emit process, and how might be the concrete structures or the structure look like when the shell be emit. So these are showing the radiation energy densities, and these are high energy radiation density, which is the shell being colliding, emerge, and started to a little bit of different fluid instabilities start to kick in. So this is the light curve I've been obtained from these radiation hydro simulations. Here, I'll show you this. The fluid instability look differently in the 3D radiation hydro case. In 2D, we see a lot of red terror fingers and starting to evolve. But in 3D radiation hydro, things, these fingers actually become sort of like a thin shell, but this shell is not perfectly spherical symmetry. This shell are like these kind of shells, and these are most of radiation coming out of from these shells. So these are like slightly with the different color because these are non-homogeneous or non-spherical shell. So you look at a different direction, that will show a different light curve, the luminosity. This is a barometric light curve of these models. So. And at the final moment, I want to advertise. I have been bringing some exposure in down. So if you are interested in the exposure, we can discuss. I also want to advertise this called the EACO Observatory. So it's called the East Asia Co-Observatory Association. It's formed by the four co-observatory in Asia, in the Japan, there's NALJ, in Taiwan, ASIA, in China, NALC. In the Korea, the CASI, they fall into like a mini ESO in the Asia, and they provide a good postdoc fellowship up to 5 years. So if a student or you are interested, please have a look. So And this is my talk. Thank you very much. Yes.
More spherical.
Yes.
So I don't. The 2D one was also additive.
The 2D one is pure hydro simulation. Yes.
But you haven't tried the 1D additive.
1D.
Additive.
Actually, I only showed you a 3D model, but actually I tried 1D, 2D, 3D radiation hydro.
What's the difference between the 1D and 3D?
Oh, the 1D. Okay, so I tell you a story, but most of people, they model supernova light curve. They show a very nice light curve and show the fixed observational data very well and just try to convince people. But in this case, if you join the 1D models, because 1D model, that's actually a fluid instability too in the 1D. However, the 1D model will be not able to simulate this instability, so they usually have a very steep or jump or density spike. Such spike usually be involved. So in the 1D, those kind of shear instability in 1D, you see a very, very thin spiky structures. Which this implies many fluid instability being observed. But however, this spike is most of people, they calculate the radiation coming out of from this spike. So that's why we do the 2D or 3D to see how differently how this spike evolve in more physical situations.
I think that's good, but what I would still recommend is that you, like the light curve you showed in the end, you perhaps overplot what the 1D analytic predictions are, and so we can actually appreciate better what the difference to the simple picture is. Mm.
Please do not tar all 1D with particular flawed instances that we have at the moment. If the 1D, and yes, I'm sorry, there are, as you know, I mean, the 1Ds are really, if the 1D is totally ignoring things like the Rayleigh-Taylor,
The principle is very simple. We have momentum conservation, energy conservation. There's very simple predictions from that, how much energy expect in terms of light. And we want to know how far away are we from these predictions.
I'm saying that it's possible to salvage more, better 1D approaches may be able to give us better than what the current 1D approaches. It may not be an inherent limitation of 1D. It may reflect the limitations of our current 1D codes.
Yes. Let me quick answer no verse. So I think this 1D actually is still the mainstream, because in the 1D we can put much more complete opacity tables and all the physics more in multi-year doing the 1D simulation. But in 2D and 3D simulations and this brings stability if they kick in and in that case, actually, the forms all the very clumpy structures. However, the radiation coming from these clumpy structures, that will change the LIGO curve. The 1D model cannot easily deal with. But
I agree with all you say, but I still want to know how big the effect is.
Exactly. Yes. Sure. Yes.
So I noted that you showed the 3D model compared to the 2D model. There are some differences in how you treated one radiation hydro and ordinary hydro. But the overall impression I had was that the 3D model, the Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities were much less pronounced.
Yes.
Kind of a little weakly warped. But surely when you go from 2D to 3D, one of the things you sacrifice is resolution.
Oh, by the way.
One question is to what extent is the lower level of really Rayleigh-Taylor structure, perhaps due to the fact that at lower resolution you have more numerical viscosity?
I think the resolution is lessly a minor issue because we also got much time in doing this simulation. So this simulation, actually, we easily can do like a 4,000 Q things. Simulation, and these are the AMR simulations. So which we have adaptive mesh refinement to refine some zones which we are interested in, like tracking the density, contrast density, and also this the radiation to do. So basically, the resolution we tend to be study also.
It also looks like it's a waste of time to simulate the whole thing, right? You could just, because it's, the scales are very small, you could just simulate a small angle of the whole exposure.
These are full star. You can, yeah, Norbert, you are right. You can simulate like a part of a star. Or the
full star shows that kind of nice spherical symmetry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
you
but
basically take a cone, right, sort of.
But you didn't do. You never know. So.
Yeah, well, you like to do the full star first to justify doing the cone.
Then you have questions from the public, or we have a large scale
mm-hmm. right? Well, no, I'm saying you need to do both, but I'm saying if resolution is an issue in 3D for the full star, then you can hone in on a cone a bit and then take higher resolution and investigate that. You know, there's no magic kind of page of money to get to your choice.
Those simulations are probably much higher than many of the simulations because these are very high resolution AMR simulation, so that's why I can say that. And the reason is just because the radiation process damping such fluid instability in growing this in 3D radiation hydro case.
With AMR, I tend to be more worried about the opposite. You have an ultraviolet catastrophe, where basically you just generate structure and if you're getting basically stuff that is very well resolved with your AMR, then it's at least maybe encouraging that whatever physics is in there, these really Taylor type structures are not
And also, but the draw point for such 3D, at least from my point, is the opacity. We cannot. Still cannot treat. I can do the multi-group radiation hydro, which have different beams of the radiation, and I can still run just such simulation and see, give you the not only light curve, but the color light curve, even maybe spectrum, 100,000 of this wave group of the wave. Yes, but the opacity is really the issue. So you want to have a better opacity, and you want to make sure you. Can run, can take it. That's a pretty complicated.
Well, I mean,
it's a pure gray opacity here.
Here, I show the gray opacity, but actually, I had done this for 16 group of the radiation hydro. And I want to generate some of the different wavelengths of the photons and to see how what is the band of this radiation actually being dominating. Depend on, because I just showed you this positional pair case. Due to the eruption energy and the different duration of the eruption, they can create some kind of superluminous supernova event. But for some of the very long duration and very diffuse one, you maybe have some of this radio or transits in this event. So that's why we want to also take a think about and doing the 2D or 3D radiation hydro cases. Try to understanding how this detail of this process has been generated and any important fluid instability can be occurs and affect this signature. But the opacity still have points to improve. A lot of things we can improve in such models.
So I have a question about mechanism of pulsation. You plot the pulsation of central temperature. And if you plot density, it's getting higher and higher. Because of the neutrino loss. And that means that the central region is quite much deviate from the unstable region of the pure instability.
Oh, yes, actually, that's...
The question is why it continues to pulsate.
Why you can't...
Usually, it probably is triggered by pure instability, but at later phase, you continue to pulsate, but it's very much different from the pulsate of the pure instability region.
Oh, these are the time. These are the time. X axis is the time. It's not the.
It's plot the density. It's getting higher and higher.
It's plotting the density.
Central density.
Central density is higher and higher.
So you
have. Yeah, I think so.
For thirds region.
Yeah, very much deviate from 4-3.
Part of the star that is in the gamma 4-3 region is not the center.
Yeah, that's
that's moving around.
Structure is basically the adiabatic. Yeah. So that means the central region is deviate from 4-3. The outer region also deviate from 4-3.
I was thinking. I was thinking about this, maybe the central part will go next move to the, now the pair instability at the late time might be not, this is my thinking, this from my personal point of view, this now might be generated from the central, more the central part of the stub, more like in the motor, the some of the outside, or shell cross the central part of the star to generate this positional pair instability and give energy to release out, to come so out.
Where is the most shell for the nuclear energy is released? Not only the center, but you said outer shell?
Yeah, so at the first pulse is happened at the center, the center of pearl. And the bond, the eruption occurs, and the center bouncing to another equilibrium state.
The
second pulse might be not just exactly the center, but starting moving out a little bit to generate positional.
But it's stable. Center part is stable.
Yes, already. Yes, right. Yes, I think.
So the other pulses are coming from farther out.
So can you show the structure of the star?
I don't have that structure, sorry.
Because that means that the outer shell structure is important when in the burning region.
Yes. That's also a very good point. But I need to total
steady. It's getting stronger and stronger, so it's we have to make sure what we are driving mechanism.
Mm. Yeah. Just thanks.
Do you have enough energy if it's in the? I mean, ultimately, your energy reservoir has to be the gravitational energy, right? If it's somewhere further out,
have nuclear
energy.
Nuclear reactions. It's not core collapse.
It's not core collapse.
These are things fuse up and. Release fusions.
So I want to see where the nuclear energy source
coming from.
Pulsation and getting stronger and stronger. It's an interesting behavior.
But the energy release would be sufficient to remove the hydrogen-rich envelope
out
of the helium core.
Yes.
Actually, of course, these are probably rare events. They are very massive stars. On the other hand, maybe they could be interesting for explaining some carbon enhanced metal pole stars, because of course they do not produce iron, but they could enrich carbon, for instance.
Yes.
I don't know if it has been studied in that direction or not yet.
I didn't show, but I was actually plot. So this kind of positional pair is the big explosion from this my 110 solar mass star case. They basically eject mass about carbon oxygen thing. Very little silicon, none of nickel or calcium, something like this. And we also believe this kind of star may be more easily formed in the early universe. Pulsar three stars, which have low metallicity, could hold on this positional pair. So that's might be also good for the carbon enriched metal pole stars.
What was the metallicity in your models?
This is actually not very low. This is a 0.1 solar metallicity.
Okay. So you're saying the ejection could be carbon rich but metal poor.
Yes.
So the less flippant answer to my earlier question seemed to be we don't see the late enough light curve to see the difference, right? The predictable difference.
Well, what we see at late times very often is when we do detect these things, if they're not at high redshift, they just have circumstellar interaction going on for years. And the shock runs into a dense wing. And so the problem from an observational point of view is that these things, if they exist, are going to produce at most something like 1% of all core collapse at Berlin, because they're very massive stars. The type 2N supernovae that are crashing into dense circumstellar shells are 8 or 9% of all core collapse. So, we have something like 10% of core collapse supernovae are fast stuff crashing into slow stuff. if you're an observer, as you notice, or as you noted, the photosphere, at least in the early phases when it's bright, the photosphere is actually outside the shock. So the shock generates energy, and that energy has to diffuse out through an optically thick wind. So we can't tell the difference between a pulsational apparent stability or a core collapse that is running into previous mass loss.
So the follow-up question is there something testable for a particular supernova rather than...
I think the most interesting or possible interesting, because this positional eruption episode, so whether if you have something, if you have seen something multi-brightening the supernova source. It bright and faint, and somehow it bright again, much brighter again. Then that will be sort of like a support how this kind of eruption episode actually can do this.
And, which of those brightens are you attributing to the pulsations?
So actually they are very interesting things, because the first eruption is actually 10 to 50 ergs of energy. So actually, the things come out, they are not these normal or less subluminous.
So you're saying you would actually get and the signature in luminosity from the first pulse before the second?
Yes,
or third
you can of, get, yes. Okay, like some of great okay. giant eruption, great. Some eruption great. Things. And in later end, when this colliding shell, I demonstrate this, when this shell energy, the collide, pure a lot of 10 to 50 ergs, or several 10 to 50 ergs of radiation, might be have you something like a very luminous or superluminous event.
So how do they, do you remember how they look different to Elliott's late time outbursts or Jim Fuller's late time outbursts?
They are outbursts, because here I just want to produce this appearance ability.
You have a beautiful thing in a computer. I'm trying to work out how we can tell which of these things is what we see.
I think the point is that
this one will be more luminous, way more luminous.
No, an alternative scenario where you have late phase oxygen burning that drives waves and causes outbursts would produce a series of fainter outbursts followed by the supernova making a very bright display. And that's very, very similar to what's predicted here. And as an observer, I can't tell the difference, because at late times, you can't see if there's nickel or not, because the surface sun interaction is much brighter than the radioactive decay anyway.
That would be the signature if you can see it, but you can't see it.
So shells crashing into other shells is sort of a generic thing that it makes it very hard to diagnose what the source of the bomb actually was.
I mean, in this scenario and that was scenario.
So 3 years, same time scale, it's oxygen burning.
But you have such a strong initial pulse in the, for example,
it's 10 to the 50 hertz followed by 10 to the 51 hertz.
That's this one, is that true in the...
That's what a core collapse does too. Yeah.
Okay, great, thank you.
Yeah. Don't you have these other odd even effects on the nucleosynthesis? That's what I've always heard from the peristability
part. Not the pulsation.
Yeah, from the peristability. I'm wondering if you have something similar as well in the pulsational.
Yeah, of course, if rheometer is decaying, yes, that's the case. Yeah.
Okay. But we can't, observations of supernovae all we see is a bright H alpha line. Unless one goes off in Andromeda.
But what are the signatures of those type 2 and supernovae is that the lines are very narrow, and suggesting that the ejecta, the material that was ejected first, is very much slower.
Narrow compared to a traditional supernova, so it's 10,000, it's...
There's a big difference in velocity. Right? Yeah. There's between 10,000 kilometers a second supernova type of ejected velocity. And something that occurred before, which was maybe 1,000 or less.
But I don't think it helps us distinguish between the different mechanisms for the pre-supernova outbursts.
I'm just saying that it might be related to what kind of velocity the initial...
Well, but the problem is that the photosphere is actually out ahead of the shock, so you never see the fast stuff until late times when it fades. Huh. Unless it's asymmetric. But then that changes the energy balance too. So it's tricky. Mm. It's hard to tell the difference, I guess, is my main point.
Okay.
telescope.
Yeah, but we know that there must be many more things than this that must be working, because it's 10% of supernovae, and these, best, these can give you 1% of all core collapse.
So if you assume the strong shockwave coming from final collapse, right from black hole, then the shockwave interacts with the just previously ejected material, so it's a quite bright supernova, which we have models in the light curve. So it's a very good candidate for the resistance of the supernova material just before the explosion.
Mm. So if I can,
which
kind of
requires to model the supernova.
So if I can kind of rephrase Nathan's point, to look for something like this, you're looking for an intrinsically rare event in the presence of a lot of false positives, and we don't understand the normal type 2Ns enough to say that any one observation is not possible, because we see a range of circumstellar material masses, velocities, etc. So to say that one thing cannot be produced by a normal eruption, there's no way to do it. Unless we have a first principles model of everything.
Pre-supernova LBV or something, or something that's ejected before the actual supernova. So that's already abnormal.
Not as crazy.
I'm going to say if you have 90% that don't do that, then you have 10% that do 1%.
Okay, thanks. So let me just make a final comment, because I want to talk about this, because there's mass loss. There's a way, like you use positional pairing stability mass you lost, and significantly, like eruption and some possible observational signature. But I just want to say, not only the mass loss rate can be by rotation or the convention or supernatant convention, try about these. These are very solid. The nuclear physics will understand it, brought up in 1, 2, 3Ds, and a very robust way to pay the bill to give out the energy to drive out the mass loss at a certain time. So this is one of these messages I want to share with everyone here.
Another way to say that is, this is the only mechanism that was actually predicted before we started this. So that part is very interesting.
Yeah.
And if the star was rotating?
Oh yeah, actually this is quite interesting. These are non-rotating known models, but if you now have a rotating known very massive star, then this positional pairing stability supernova regime will change. So mass scale will scale down. So they will easily to form more massive core due to this rotational mixing. And in that case, this usually I show this scale is 80 to 140, then you shift down by a mass scale like a 20 or something, then you probably have a 60 or 50 solar mass stars, then you can have this kind of positional pair in
but
event.
What's the mass range? How does rotation affect the physics?
It affects the physics, because if it affects the rotation, when you have a rotation, when you start to evolve, then you have a maybe chemical homogeneous mixing something, then you can easily form a more massive helium core, which are required to satisfy.
My question was whether the rotation affects any asymmetry during the collapse, during the supernova.
Yes, that's some very interesting thing. So, but I didn't show. This is a very interesting thing, because we also think about there's a rotationally positional pairing stability supernova. When they die, they make a lot of pearls, and at the end, they didn't form black hole, but instead the magenta. And you have the magenta coming out from these. So these are sort of very more exhausting positional pair plus magenta superluminous. Well, these are not completely crazy, but.
This goes too fast for me. I'm wondering how from such a huge core you can claim you get a neutron star out of the black hole. How does that work?
See, you can talk to Stan here while
Stan can do anything.
You have this Vestalon cluster where you have these very massive stars, and still there is a magnetar in there.
So why can't you explain by binary? Because the most massive star there are 40, they still not 150 with every
okay.
So it's
okay,
big
okay, you do it as a binary, okay.
You like that, right? that's near that's up your alley.
So have you done those what 18 simulations?
I done with it's a 2D, actually memory 2D is easier, so 2D rotational pairing stability supernova explosion. But actually I found the rotational explosion, but it's a pairing stability, not positional pair. So this like I saw these asymmetry structures during the nuclear burning when the collapse. In general, the asymmetry structure, like when you explode, due to the rotational effect, actually nickel production was decreased, and also this ejectile looked like a, not like a real jet, but more like a, it's not just like a boom, like this kind of, like this more vertical sphere of the explosion, not like boom, like this way. And due to this, also this, because the rotation shot a lot of mass out, basically in this case, there's an internal reverse shock mixing are not very significant in this model compared with I usually do this top 3 pair stability supernova explosions. And these are some of these models I published. So.
One short comment about this.
Yes.
Rotational pair instability is sort of shown already by Zalman Bakker in 1967.
Mm.
So I think he should have credit.
Yes. Sorry. So I think that many people maybe can also actually did many things. So you also have the this. Yeah, but you are right. But I think this because I think this thing I'm not sure. But in my understanding, the Mesa core cannot do the hydro explosion.
Which means that's one of the things I'm working on.
Yes, so that's why it's also good if you, the Mesa community also have such kind of a set. But Norbert, your code can, you okay?
Yeah, but it has the same, it solves the same equation as the Mesa code, so
no. Basic code is changing. It did.
All right.
It doesn't.
So then even in your previous form, the Mesa code should be able to do it.
Should be and can are also very different. Yeah, I don't think it works in the curve. The pulsational pair stability thing, where is he? There's somebody who's killing me, asking me to make it work, or helping try to make it work, and it's not working. So,
okay, I was thinking to join his effort in bugging you.
Hmm?
I was thinking to join Matthew's effort.
Perfect. Wonderful, wonderful. Good luck, guys.
I know you have to ask to make it work.
The things that I've been spending my time on last year have to do with trying to do a better job with the hydro in terms of moving into an approximate Riemann solver, doing a better job with that. And we're also working to implement a 1D modeling of the effects of Rayleigh-Taylor from Paul Duffel's work. So some of those things are coming along nicely. Whether it's going to take it to this level or not, I have absolutely no idea. This is getting, I don't know, but in terms of trying to improve the ability of 1D codes to make predictions of what you might actually get as a light curve from more of a standard vanilla 2P kind of thing, there's interesting things happening. I don't know whether it's going to be useful or not, but there are interesting things happening and changes in Mesa. I don't think you can do a pair. The pair stability, yeah, we've been able to take 150 solar mass guy and run it off that cliff and get the pair. So the pulsational one is much, we have never been able to make anything as beautiful as this stuff. This is gorgeous. No, I've never seen that come out of Mesa, and I wouldn't be surprised
because
if it was not possible.
Because the Kepler code then use Stan and Tom Weaver and those guys. Because this need a good hydro component to do the explosion.
Yeah, but that's from 1978 or something.
Right. It's not because of the quality of the hydro. I can put in quality. Hydro loop is much higher quality than what is done in 1978. We were brilliant, but it was in 1978. So it's not that. There's other magic that goes on inside there, and who knows? So,
yeah. I can't
reproduce.
Actually, I want to also comment this, the final comment, sorry for delay. So the companion's problem, like whether we can really blow up the like 20 solar mass star, 15, 19, 80, 21 solar mass stars. And then you see these islands, about some of you can blow up. These are complicated, and these are complicated above beyond. I mean, because for example, I'm not sure about the Kepler Mesa code, but the Kepler code is, if you read the Torg and Stan's paper carefully, then you will know those models, the result not only depends on what kind of parameters you're using, but it also depends on what kind of computer code compilers or machine you are running on. So, these are so complicated. So you just point one solar mass difference in mass, and then you can blow up, or you cannot blow up. But this is complicated. So
you and I are on the same page there. The problem is that sometimes these plots like that get put forward, and all of those uncertainties and caveats get ignored.
So
then I hear people quoting that, oh, 25 yes and 24 no.
Instead of islands of explodability, it should be islands of numerical instability.
Uncertainty. Yes, so there's a huge amount of numerical uncertainty.
It's called islands of numerical stability in the ocean. Numerical instability.
Yes, for
the state will just say these are about some kind of digits of the machines and start to generate different. That means you run the same code using the same parameters. You run on different machine. Or different compiler of your code, maybe you give a different result at the end.
Mesa, that one I have handled. But you will get different results if you change the time. Nobody bothers, these are so complicated computations that it's extremely rare to see a convergence study in the sense that saying we're no longer dependent on resolution. I mean, you guys doing the multi-D stuff are very good about that, and the people doing 1D are very bad about it in general, I think. So you don't see have my results really rock solidly converged here? Am I taking small enough time steps? Do I have enough spatial resolution? Those are issues that rarely get addressed, but are very important. So
yes.
All of these results are uncertain to that extent as well.
Yes. Okay, thanks.